frequent watchers of the Bundesliga or La Liga on ESPN this season, there's one unmistakable voice that you'll grow fond of, and that's that of Mark Donaldson, who carries around his famous Scottish accent calling games that feature Borussia Dortmund, Bayern Munich, Barcelona, Real Madrid. He's become a mainstay for American watchers of those leagues. So today we're going to circle back to a talk that I had with Mark Donaldson back in 2021, where we just kind of get into the ins and outs of his career. Now, this is part of our show-and-tell series, so if you haven't seen that over on YouTube, I do encourage you all to go over to the World Soccer Talk YouTube channel and check that out. But we are going to circle back to the audio version today. We're just going to talk about Mark's career, how he got into calling games, his passion for hearts, and really just his relationship with Paul Mariner, who he was very fond of before he passed away. So I'm going to throw it back over to Kyle from the past, and we're going to get into that conversation with Mark Donaldson. And thank you all for listening, and hope you all have a great day. So thank you. Just jump right into it. If you could, Mark, could you just kind of give a background on yourself, who you are, where you're from, and what you do every day in the soccer media or just for ESPN in general?
Yeah, well, in the soccer media, I've been a commentator since 1996, simply because the colleague who I was working with at Radio 4th in Edinburgh forgot his spectacles and couldn't see. So I commentated on Hearts against Porto, and the rest is history. It was a pre-season friendly, and it's led me to Connecticut more than goodness knows how many years later, doing a job that I love.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, everyone knows that accent, so definitely from Scotland. How is it different living in the U.S. compared to Scotland? Do you miss certain parts of it? Are there some things that are better here? Or, you know, just like the general vibe of the States compared to Scotland?
Well, I really miss going back to Scotland. I've not been home for 2.5 years since I went to see my team Hearts play Celtic in the Cup Final in 2019 just as a fan. So that's been tough, not seeing my parents for that length of time. But what hasn't been tough is that anytime I do go back, I always get told, oh, you sound like Sheena Easton, that mid-Atlantic accent with the American twang. You're a St. Pete's boy, you're a Florida boy. I got your accent wrong because I thought you were from the northern part of the United States, but I didn't hear you say about, because then it would have given it away if you were from the north. But when I do go home, you get the abuse. It's just your pals being your pals and having a right go. So I've not missed that, but I'm delighted to see I'm going home for the first time in 2.5 years next month to see my folks. It's funny, Kyle, I say I'm going home. This is home for me now. I've been here 11 years. I'm a United States citizen. I'm also a British citizen as well. But no matter where you're from in the world and where you end up in the world, there's always that little place called home. And for me, home might be here in Connecticut, but the real home, and always will be, I suppose, is Edinburgh in Scotland.
Before we get into more about the soccer stuff, I want to ask you about caps off and your experience with baseball and sports outside of soccer. I would assume that being from Scotland, soccer was always your first passion. And I know you're a fan of Hearts, but you are obviously very involved in baseball and tennis coverage. Can you kind of talk about how you got into that world and what that's meant to you?
Yeah, being from the UK, football was obviously the main thing, and I was a football commentator for many years. But I got made redundant in 2008, Christmas Eve, and didn't know what I was going to do from a radio station in Edinburgh called Talk 107. And I went freelance the following week. I'd already written a couple of books about Hearts, because I've always felt when you get the opportunity to diversify in the industry that we're in, it's very difficult to just be that one guy or that one girl that does that one thing. Because ultimately now, if you can do 3 or 4 things for the same price or the same cost that one person does that one thing, I know where your bosses are going to be looking at. But you've got to be careful. You don't become jack of all trades and master of none. So you've got to have a kind of limit to what you do. So I went freelance. I struggled with timekeeping because you want to take on everything because you're frightened to say no. But if you don't take on something, then someone else might get it. But your home life can suffer because you never see your family. So that can be difficult. But the baseball aspect of things came about in that I was just what they were looking for in that. Well, I'll tell you a story about that in a second, but I wasn't the expert. We had an expert. I was a Brit with an interest, a keen interest in a sport without being an expert. Initially, one of my former bosses came to me and said, do you know any good looking young Brits that are interested in baseball? I said, well, not really, but what about me? And after many screen tests, I got that gig. I am what I am. I like a laugh in commentary to a point. I think it's still a serious business, but you've got to try and make the people entertained that are watching it. We are just an accompaniment, and it gets frustrating at times that sometimes there are certain commentators, and thankfully I think they're in the minority, and I'm not going to name any names, that want to be the star. But most of us don't want. We're just the accompaniment. We're the captain of the ship. We just ensure it goes the right way, whether it's the person alongside us or whether it's the game itself. There's many other facets to that. So I'm self-deprecating. That's what I am. I like a bit of good humor. I always go into it as well prepared as I can be, with the key caveat that I know what I don't know. And when it comes to baseball, and to an extent tennis, if we're covering something that your average supporter or your average fan watches 24/7, 365 days of the year, we don't. We can dip in and out. So we've got to know what we don't know. So don't guess. Don't pretend you know. So whether it's tennis, which, having done the commentary again at the US Open this year for the 11th year in a row, tennis is interesting because it's a sport that the commentator only commentates when there's no action taking place, because you shouldn't really talk during a point. So that kind of started way back in 2001, I think it was, when I covered the National Tennis Championships in Telford. And I was commentating on one of my good friends at the time, a guy called Nick Lester, who's now one of the best TV commentators for tennis. I didn't know it at the time. Worked with him over the years and told him my first tennis gig was in 2001, and I was commentating on him. So it's funny how things work in this kind of world that we live in. But ultimately, when I deviate away from the sport I know best, football or soccer, the key thing for me is knowing what I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So now we're going to jump into the things you may have brought. So what did you bring? What's the first thing that you brought to? other than apple juice, something maybe more soccer related.
Okay, so we're going to start with this thing here, right? So I'll show you the patch on the sleeve. It's a FIFA World Cup Germany qualifying top, Scotland, when they played against Italy in the qualifiers. So this is Paul Hartley. So I didn't even see two mark, best wishes, Paul Hartley. The story behind that goes as follows. I was working at Radio 4th at the time, and I got a call from Paul. Right, don't tell anybody this, but I need you to help me. I'll see what I can do. What is it? He said, I need a pair of tickets for M People, because I love Heather Small, who was the lead singer. No wonder you don't want me to tell anybody. He goes, no, see what you can do. So I asked a good friend of mine, Scott Wilson, he's a brilliant guy who was the drive time host at Radio 4th in Edinburgh where I worked. He's now, and has been for many years, the voice of Hearts. He does the Tannoy announcements, the public address system. Phoned him, and he's like, honestly, I could ask for two tickets to the Oval Office in the White House, and he'd find a way somehow to get me in by hook or by crook. So he said, I'll sort it out. So he did. He did. So next time I was up at Hearts, I got told, I think by the manager, whoever, said there's something for you at reception, whatever. So I went after the press conference and picked up. And it was this. It was Paul Hartley's Scotland top, and just had a note saying, cheers, big man. And I waited maybe 5 or 6 years before telling that story. But I think now that he's out of football and not so much in the dressing room as a player, he's now doing a decent job as a coach. I can tell that story now. But that's my first one. And that was the qualifying campaign whereby we came so close. We had to face Italy on the final day, knowing we needed a win to get through to the World Cup in Germany. And I was working freelance for Talk Sport at the time, and as I have been doing since kind of 2007. And this was just before that. And I was working with, in fact, I might even have kind of totally deviated off the subject here, because this might have been the Italy game whereby it was the following. No, I think I'm right. I think it was the Italy campaign that we nearly qualified for. But anyway, I was doing the game with Alan Brazil at Hampden, and he disappeared at halftime because he had to go for a liquid lunch date with Rod Stewart in the centre of Glasgow, where he'd already been, and he wanted to get there first and wait for Rod Stewart on the way back. That's his story. But yeah, there's a lot of kind of stories behind things that I have, how I got them and whatever. But I never like kind of, oh, can I have? I want to be able to kind of give in return for for getting. There have been one or two that I've just been offered, which is nice, but that's the first thing that I've kind of brought. And now I have to try and remember if it was the qualifying campaign where we came so close under Alex McLeish, or it was a previous one. I tell you what it was. I think it was the Euros that we came so close to qualifying in 2008. That was for the World Cup. The same story applies. It was the M People tickets in Glasgow that we were able to get for the Scotland midfielder, Paul Hartley.
Gotcha. Yeah, let's we can snap back to the actual topic. Did you bring anything else? Anything else that'd be interesting?
This is a Hearts jersey from 1980. It's actually from 84, but the jerseys, the 1985 jerseys, didn't come in time, so they put a big patch on it. But it was worn by John Robertson, who was a hero of mine growing up. John's like 5'5", and I used to wear this as pajamas going to bed. That would now fit my 3-year-old daughter. Because John wasn't the biggest, it's probably a medium. But that's just a kind of nod. And you see the material. Take this back again. You look at the inside and the material. It's like toweling and everything like that. I mean, back in the day, people who played football, the breathe right material and the dry fit didn't exist. These are pretty heavy to wear. When that gets hot and sweaty and soaking wet, that couldn't have been too comfortable. So that's the second one. Speaking of which, if you don't mind kind of going on to this one here. This is, we're going back to the Italy theme again. This is a Scotland away jersey from 1964 when they played Italy in a World Cup qualifier. And this was given to me by my uncle, Ali Donaldson, who, if you don't mind, I can just go up here. I don't know if you can see this. That's fine. Let's just tilt this up. Hold on. You know what? It's up there. It's right at the top.
Okay.
So he played for Dundee in the semi-final of what is now the Europa League in 1968 against Leeds. And he gave me, I have no use for this. I didn't even know what kind of where it was from, if it was a training top or whatever. But it came from a coaching course that he did in the early 80s after he'd retired. He used to play for Dundee and he played many games. And what they used to do with the old Scotland jerseys, they just kind of gave them to the coaches because they only had one. It's not like you change at halftime or whatever. It's an old Umbro one. And that's what, 57 years old. So that I've kind of got that in my family with my uncle having played in goal. My father and my mother took me to my first Hearts game in the early 80s. So there's your Hearts and there's your Scotland. So that's, I've got one left after this, but that's your kind of three football tops. I've got so many others, but that's the kind of three that have a story that I wanted to kind of explain.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you got some jerseys or tops that are framed, like the one that's on your right and the one on your left, obviously, in the Scotland one you just showed, but then you have other jerseys behind you that are not framed. Is there like a distinction as to why some are framed, some aren't, or are there some jerseys that you like looking at more, or do they go away or something?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to frame them all. I'm just going to, this is not very technical, but those there, I've got the Pele jersey. Lucky enough to meet Pele when, again, go back to Giovanni Savarese. He was coach of the Cosmos before he went to Portland. And Pele used to, hopefully his health gets better. He used to go to the kind of first game of the season with the Cosmos. So I was invited down to that one by Gio. And the other one is Mario Kempes, a 1978 signed jersey, because Mario is a former colleague. Well, I said former colleague. He is a colleague, but he's now moved down to Florida. So anytime if you watch Deportes and you hear Mario with Fernando, who lives up here, they are doing it. Fernando being the studio, Mario is doing it from home. And I now have experience of from home commentary, having done it for the first time via a box, a little device called Kizway is the whole thing. That's a Motu, M-O-T-U box, a commentary box, which... we do, because if facilities aren't available at ESPN, if it's a busy day with college football or whatever, we have a producer in their house and we will do the game from our house.
Yeah, when you covered Serie A in Italy, did you ever go to those games or were those all done in the booths at ESPN in Connecticut?
Yeah, we did Roma Juventus in 2019, I think it was May 2019, from the stadium. Which we would have liked to have done an earlier game. Again, facilities and logistics weren't easy as far as picking a game is concerned, because ideally you would like a title win or whatever. But that's when you've got to arrange for as many things as that. You can always do a game and it's in the first 2 or 3 weeks of the season. Like, for example, we did La Liga. We had a full team on site for the first game of the season that we did, Barcelona, and we did commentary of Real Madrid the day before, away from home. But yeah, done a few games on site. But again, as I said, with regards to doing a game from home, I don't say that I'm in the stadium or anything like that. In the stadium, I think I'm not going to go, we're here, because a commentary should be a commentary regardless. All I'm in the stadium, I'm able to see a kind of wider periphery, whereas I can see what you can see when we're doing a game on site. Sorry, when we're doing a game in the studio. But if we're doing a game on site, you don't preach the fact that you're there more than you would if you're not there. I think you've got to kind of keep a level kind of playing. If you see something, you say something, but you don't say, because I'm here, I can see that. You don't want to make it too obvious. But again, it's totally subjective what viewers want from their commentator. Some people might say, well, a lot of the time there's in vision. We were in vision. We did an intro to that game from trackside at halftime. We were on camera. At full time, we did an on-camera wrap. That's enough. People can see we're there. We don't need to make reference to it all the time, because what it's doing is referencing the fact that, why are we only here for this one and not doing the rest?
Yep. All right. Well, we can go into that final thing you brought if you want. We can wrap up with that.
Yeah, so it's a couple of things here. And funnily enough, this is the 5-year anniversary of the launch of Stevie Nichols' book, The Liverpool Legend. Get to that in a minute. This is the first one I did, which is called Believe, From Turmoil to Triumph at Tynecastle. It's a story about when George Burley was the manager and was unbeaten in the first 10 games, the owner sacked him. The owner was a crazy Russian-Lithuanian megalomaniac who was annoyed that he didn't get all the praise and the manager was getting all the praise. So I kind of wrote a wee expose. And I was good friends. There's Paul Hartley on the front, whose jersey it was. It's called Believe because that's the name on the back of the T-shirt when we qualified for the Champions League preliminary stage. We didn't get through to the group stages. But the forward is by Stephen Presley, who was captain at the time. And it got a fair bit of publicity because he came out and said, regardless of who the owner is, it should be the manager that picks the team. And he got in trouble for that. That was after he had an impromptu press conference with Paul Hartley and Craig Gordon, the Scotland goalkeeper, who's still at Hearts, where they came and had a rant. And ultimately, all three never played for the football club again. After a few months, they got rid of him. The whole idea behind the owner coming in and buying the football club was, with Lithuania being a part of the European Union at the stage, having just been admitted, he saw it as a platform to showcase all the Lithuanian players, sell them, make millions, and then disappear again. I think he's now on the run in Chechnya or whatever. He left a sorry mess at Hearts, and we went into administration. Thankfully, we're now fan-owned. There's 8,000 of us that all pay money every month to the football club, which I love, and we're doing all right. This is the second one. 5 years ago, this was launched. Stevie Nichol, my autobiography. 5 league titles and a packet of crisps, i.e. a packet of chips, because Stevie Nichol was a fantastic footballer with the worst diet in the world. And it's a play on a UK sitcom, 2 pints of lager and a packet of crisps. And most of it is about off-the-field activities, what he got up to, the fun that he had. He was the butt of so many jokes, but he could take it. And plus a hell of a lot of achievements in one of the greatest, I think, British teams that we've ever seen, the Liverpool of the early 80s. There's been a lot of really good teams, but Liverpool have got to be mentioned in that conversation. So that's 2 of the 3 books I've written. The next one, which I've done, which I'm sure is going to be my last because of the emotional attachment, Paul Mariner's autobiography. Sadly, Paul lost his life from glioblastoma, brain tumour, a couple of months ago. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. But I got there and I just wanted it to be a legacy. And it comes out hopefully end of October, start November. Paul Mariner's autobiography, My Rock and Roll Football Life, I think it's called. And I just want it to be a legacy for his family and something that, as well as the memories they have of dad or partner or son, because his mom's still alive, I want it to be something that they can look back on and go, yeah, my boy or my dad or whatever achieved a hell of a lot in football. But like Stevie's book, because the pair of them were together at New England Revolution, there's a bit about football, but most of it is just stories about fun and daft things that they did. I mean, some of the stuff with the goalkeeping coach at New England Revolution, they gave him a 10-yard head start in a race. And then Taylor Twellman and the rest of them were on the sidelines cheering on, go on, you can do this, you can do this. He was the only one that was running because they didn't bother running in behind. They just videotaped this overweight goalkeeping coach who had gout at the time and could hardly walk, but he was desperate to win this race. He was the only person in the race. That was them. Their whole environment, Stevie Nicol and Paul Mariner, was about fun, players enjoying it. You ask any of the players they had at the Revs, and I'm sure the majority of them, those that they picked on a regular basis, would say how much fun it was. It was difficult for Paul when he went up to Toronto. That was a tough one. But it was also tough for the book not really being able to speak to Paul because of the radiotherapy and the chemotherapy attacking his kind of his memory. So it's about him. It's his life story. But a lot of it is told by others, including Jürgen Klinsmann from their time together at Toronto. It's got a foreword by Ian Gillan of Deep Purple, one of his best friends, and some of the stories there. Just as well, social media wasn't a thing back in the day because I'm sure a lot of them might have had to make a phone call from jail cells to get themselves out of that after a night on a bender. But just that's the way it was.
Yeah, I'll wrap up with this. You talk about how a lot of those books is just them having fun, and that's not necessarily on the field stuff. I mean, people might say like their greatest achievement was winning the Champions League World Cup or calling a major game like that. But I want to ask you, as a commentator, what is, or at least someone in the media industry, what is the most fun you've had? And this is keeping it in the world of soccer.
As a commentator, a game that I've done or somewhere that I've traveled?
Yeah, a little bit of both. It could be like I really enjoy going to this country, or I went to a great game just between like just two Premier League teams or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite games was Newcastle-Barcelona. I didn't commentate on that one. It was just as a fan. One of my, my first girlfriend was from Newcastle, and I went to see that game, Tino Asprilla scoring a hat-trick in the Champions League group stage, which was a night I'll never forget. As a Hearts fan, winning the Cup 5-1 against our rivals, Hibernian at Hampden. But I think doing what I've kind of done and growing up, I've done some Rangers and Celtic commentaries, in fact, quite a lot over the years. But the teams that I covered on a weekly basis were from the East Coast to Scotland. And when they qualified for Europe, we got to go to places. You're not starting in group stages of European competitions. You're starting before the previous year's tournament isn't even finished yet. Mm-hmm. It's that early. So trips to Sarajevo, to Mostar, to Reykjavik, to Liechtenstein, to places you wouldn't know. Where do you want to go today? Oh, let's go to Vaduz and Liechtenstein. You're not going to say that. So just getting to see these places and getting to commentate from stadiums like that, where it's not show up and everything's done for you. It's there's $10 or 10, whatever the local currency is, to the local engineer to make sure the power's switched on. That's proper football. That's grassroots football. And you've got to take the bad with the good. And I think you appreciate the good more if you've had the bad, if you've had the rough times, the things that didn't quite work. You find a way to make them work if you can, and that makes you stronger going forward. So, of course, we'd all have something in the past in our work, whether it's me broadcasting or whatever, that maybe didn't go according to plan, but it's how we react to that. There's going to come a time where my three-year-old daughter barges in as I'm doing a Bundesliga or a Spanish game or something and goes, Daddy, I need a pee-pee or something like that. But that is what it is. That's modern-day life in media. It's not what we would hope for. We want to be in stadiums. We want to go to cities. We're starting to get back there now, but we just have to adapt. And you know what? I wouldn't say it's a job. I think this is a hobby, what we do. So if adapting is what we have to do to make sure that we have this hobby and a continuation of working in a hobby, then that's good enough for me. Just don't take anything for granted because you never know if it's going to be your last.
Very true. I mean, that's a great way to wrap it up, Mark.
Yeah, you've got a lot of editing to do as well, Kyle.
That's all right. It's all good stuff.
And keep going with the website because it's a great source of information. You, Chris, and Kartik, the weekly podcast as well is a must for me. And it's nice to hear your own name. I don't care whether it's a negative or a positive thing. I think everyone deep down cares. But if you do get whether it's negative or constructive comments, which Chris and Kartik and some of the guests give because they're honest, that's the way they want to be. I don't see that as a bad. I think, okay, well, if that's what they think, then you think, well, is that what I'm doing? And if it is something that you didn't know was a fault of yours and they have picked up on that, then I think that's a good thing. So I love the honesty of the podcast, and good luck to you going forward as well, because you've got a super guy and Chris Harris and Kartik to work with as well. So fingers crossed, this is just the start for you two.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Thanks, Mark.